Benjamin Myers is the kind of writer who has devoted readers. A series of novels over the last 15 years or so, particularly those published by indie imprint Blue Moose, have earned him awards, plaudits, and many dedicated booksellers keen to hand-sell his books. His prolific output belies the fact that for the last 5 years he has been working on Cuddy, a novel that takes inspiration from St. Cuthbert, the unofficial patron saint of the north of England. What led an atheist to write a novel about faith? And how did he alight on the book's multiple timelines and connected narratives? Join us as we find out. Where to begin, Ben? That is the main question. And with a book like this, it's actually quite hard to know where to begin. Usually I'm really clear about these things. And as I was approaching this morning, I thought, oh, I'm not quite sure where to begin. I guess we begin with Cuddy. And I wonder whether you could tell me, I suppose, when you as a child were sort of first aware of who he was, or perhaps the importance of Durham Cathedral, or sort of where this entered your life, because it's clear that it entered your life when you were younger.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to make sense of it myself, really. It's not very long since I actually finished the book and now have the physical object in my hand. It's been a fairly quick turnaround by publishing terms. So I'm in that kind of aftershock dazed stage where you just sort of, you see the book, you see the words on the page, and it's only now that I begin to try and work out what it is I've written and why. But yeah, Cuddy is the affectionate nickname for St. Cuthbert, who is the unofficial patron saint of the north of England, really. He's probably the most significant saint. And his remains were he died in the 7th century on the holy island of Lindisfarne, a tidal island off the coasts of Northumberland, and his body was carried around for 100 years until it was decided that a sort of suitably grand monument should be erected. So instead of a headstone, he got a cathedral built over him, and that's Durham Cathedral. That's the potted history, really. But I grew up about 3 miles away from the cathedral in a suburb of the city. So like anyone who grows up in such places, I was just aware of this grand building, which I took for granted, really. You know, it's one of the sort of recognized wonders of Norman architecture. It turned 1,000 years old in the 1990s when I was sort of coming of age, just at the age I was leaving Durham, actually. And, but you know, around it is a normal city. Durham is a city, but really it's a town. It's a small city, and it's got, you know, like shopping precincts built in the 1960s, which have already been and gone, and life changes all around the cathedral, but that has sort of remained a constant. So yeah, as a kid, I was kind of given a lot of free rein to just wander around. And from the age of about 7, I was allowed to just go out for the day with a pound or two in my pocket, take the bus into Durham, and spend a full day out by myself, which when I tell people now, they're quite sort of horrified. They would have letting their kids out, although it's probably safer for kids now than back then.
Yeah.
Nothing bad happened that I can recall. But yeah, so on these wanderings, I'd wander around the city and often ended up at the cathedral by myself or sometimes with friends. And you can, you know, it's free and it's open to the public, so I would just wander around, and you could pay 50 pence to climb up the tower, which takes you to the highest point around. The cathedral's built on a peninsula, so it's already at a high spot. And it's nearly surrounded by a moat by the natural curve of the river, which is why it was built there. But I didn't really know much about St. Cuthbert himself growing up, other than the fact that he was one of several saints whose names appear on street signs and you know, it's just part of the cultural fabric, I guess, of the place. And not being religious, I only kind of understood the very basics of who he was. And then it was a few years ago, I started reading up on him. And I guess the idea for the book came because I wanted to write about the cathedral. And I'd spent some time on Holy Island as well, which is quite a fascinating place. And I was sort of made aware that the birthplace of Christianity in Britain is the northeast of England. And also kind of a lot of what we now see as modern England, a lot of things happened around the Northeast that kind of grew into what we recognize as the country today, even though it was more sort of kingdoms back then. So I wanted to write about that, and I wanted to write about or cover the fact that the Northeast is, well, it's economically the poorest part of the country, and culturally it's often overlooked in terms of investment. And I don't know, we just had the grandiose and arrogant idea of trying to write an alternative history of the Northeast of England, starting somewhere between Durham Cathedral and Holy Island. I had this image of these two places, and thought, well, what's the story, sort of thing. And then it was after a few months I realised St Cuthbert was the link. He died on Lindisfarne. He was transported around by this community of acolytes for 100 years, and then he was buried in the ground in a cathedral built for him. So it began then. It's taken 5 years. It's probably going to be sort of described as a historical novel, but I just see it as a novel, or rather four novellas, which are sort of interlinked to form a novel.
Well, it's interesting that you said that, because as you say, like, somebody being enthused by the story of St. Cuthbert, for example, or of Durham Cathedral, there are so many ways that you could write a book about that. But you have chosen to, yes, go right back to the time when St. Cuthbert was alive, and then follow, as you said, that group of acolytes who ended up finding the spot for Durham Cathedral to be built. But you do bring the story right up to almost the present day, to 2019. And it is about this kind of enduring connection, I suppose, between these different groups of people, different times, all joined together in some way by the story of Cuddy, which I found really, really interesting. But did you, how soon did you alight on the idea of having this sort of story told through time?
Well, I think quite early on I realised that I didn't want to sit down and write a sort of linear, straightforward novel, because I've been quite busy these past, well, I've put out a lot of books. I've put out about 10 books in 10 years or something. Yeah. And I love writing, and I had this idea for something, but I just couldn't face the prospect of writing a straightforward novel. It's easier and possibly lazier to kind of approach it in a piecemeal way. So originally I was going to write 10 stories set something like 100 years apart, taking us over 1,000 years. And then I realized that's grossly ambitious. And the thing is, I'm not a historian. I got as far as GCSE history and I got a B, and that's as far as it went. But I am interested in people, and I'm interested in people throughout the ages. And writing this book, I read a lot of history texts. I ploughed through a lot of books about St. Cuthbert, about Christianity, about Durham, about architecture. And there's some amazing books. But what a lot of historians possibly lack is that kind of the poetry of bringing the story to life and colouring it in. And what I lack is academic rigour and qualifications in terms of history. So I approached it from how I approach everything, really, which is from a personal sort of on the ground level. And Cuddy really is the story of a place, Durham Cathedral, throughout the ages. And it's a story of, well, the other thing about historical novels, it's they're often told about the focus on significant people throughout history or the victors. So I wanted to write about just the small everyday voices throughout history, because everyone's life at some point is extraordinary. And the thought I always come back to as well is that whether it's sort of 7th century or 12th century or it's 1827 or 2019, that date is always the most modern point in period for that time. Mm. So we think of the 1300s has been a bleak period I say that as because one of the stories is set there, has been a bleak, primitive period where people had were rolling around in the mud like hogs, and you know, when in fact, yes, probably we're doing that, and we're still doing it today, but we're also capable of engineering and architecture and philosophy and astronomy and burgeoning science, scientific discovery. So I tried to occupy that space between factual research-based history. So I did the research, and then I sort of inject my own sense of artistic license and imagination. And at that point, when I started writing the book, the first section I wrote, and people probably won't have read the book at this point, but is the fourth book, which is set, as you say, in 2019. That's the one I started writing first. So when I began the book, it was actually set in 2020, but begun in 2018. But by the time 2020 came around, the pandemic had happened. And I realized this story that I was setting 2 years in the future could not take place in 2020 as I'd written it, because no one was socializing. So I moved it forward a year to 2019. And then I realized I had to tell the story of Cuthbert himself, and there's hundreds of books in which he features. And I thought, there's no point me writing a straightforward book about him. So for the book one in Cuddy, I've got a kind of chorus of voices, which are excerpts from real historic texts telling us Cuthbert's story. And without sounding too pretentious about it, it's almost like a sampling or remixing, I think. You know how music can be built from other people's work. You layer in samples and beats. And I saw it as that approach, and that as samples, the quotes credited and, you know, not stolen from far greater historians, from sort of from the Venerable Bede through to contemporary writers. Simon Sharma or whoever, Peter Ackroyd. There's just a quote from lots of sources to help build up the backstory, which actually took quite a long time to do, because I had to trawl through a lot of books and then pull out the pertinent bits and then arrange them into some sort of order. So it probably would have been easier and quicker to actually just sit down and write Cuthbert's story. But why would I do that? Because that already exists. And as I said, I'm not an academic. I'm just like a strange man sat in a room trying to work out ways of stories in new ways, I guess.
Well, what's interesting about those historical sources, as you say, is that you did the hard work of going through all those books and finding the pertinent bits and bringing them together. But what I found really interesting was how contradictory they are. So that one historical source will describe him as being one way and the other will completely contradict it. And it shows you why even what we would consider to be the factual version of history they can't all be right. So that's why we need fiction sometimes, to make something slightly more coherent. And I'm really interested to hear that you began the book with the section in 2019, because that involves a young man called Michael working within Durham Cathedral. And there he meets these people who are doing some restoration work on the stonework. And the idea of these stonemasons finding the sort of little marks, and I guess what you might term graffiti, but from the Middle Ages, and wondering and trying to work out who had put that there and what it means. And actually, I suppose the rest of the book fills in those gaps, or writes into those gaps. And we do actually meet one of the stonemasons at one point in the novel, and find out so much more about what's going on there. I suppose, is that part of the appeal, to kind of take something really fragmentary and tiny and to enlarge it into something much bigger?
Yeah, I think so. I guess it's a form of sort of like living archaeology that's, you know, without having to dig, it's there in front of you, in this case in Durham Cathedral. I mean, when I started researching the book in, I think, probably 2018, so it's about 5 years ago since I started, there was major restorations taking place on the cathedral's top towers. So the characters I write about, the masons who were up on this kind of windy peak of the building during winter, they existed. I've made characters out of them, but I couldn't go up the tower to do research because it was closed because of this masonry work. So I thought, well, that in itself is quite interesting. You know, what should have been a hurdle, you know, I can't get access to the cathedral. I turned into a part of the story, really. But yeah, I like the idea of, as I said, it began as kind of four novellas, which I wrote quite separately and treated each one as like a novel, in which I would spend 6 months working on each one. But I wanted to stitch it together and have it as a novel rather than a collection of stories. And so I had to kind of weave in these threads that hold it together, certain recurring motifs, recurring family names or images. There's little things that pop up in different parts of the book, like the image of a crab appears a few times. But yeah, the masonry marks as the sigils that they would carve into the stones is something that really appears. Your question was interesting because it kind of makes it sound as if I planned it all so that I would have these hidden mason marks, which would be like a callback to the mason character of 700 years earlier. But at that point, the stone mason story I had a major block, if you like, unintended. But I'd kind of written three quarters of the book and I had a whole story to write and I didn't know what it was going to be. And it was the stonemason story, really. And I sort of literally packed a suitcase and went to stay by the sea near Robin Hood's Bay, where one of my previous novels, The Offing, was set. And I thought, I'm not going to leave until I've got an idea and mapped it out. So I kind of sat in this little cabin thinking, you know, you've got to finish this novel. What's it going to be about? And all I had was the idea of a mason. So that turned into what became book two of Cuddy.
Yeah.
And then you start adding. I mean, the great thing about writing fiction is that you can do what you want. So you're not, you know, I did the research so that historically it's hopefully watertight in terms of chronology and architectural details, but then you can start adding in bits that pull it together and you can add fictional characters and you can create a stonemason who leaves a mark on a stone and then 700 years or 300 pages later, someone who's working on a building site today uncovers that stone. So it's, I think it's the novel, I guess, is about the layering of time and sort of time travel as a real concept that me as the writer and readers can kind of embark upon. There's quite a few hidden little things in the book that I added quite late, which hopefully people will spot. And it might be on a second reading if people could stand to go back to it. They would spot little things, and ancestors of characters early on reappear. And it's layered, and I kept adding little details onto the basic stories just to make it a more sort of, if I'm going to write something historic, it has to be layered, and it has to be something immersive, I think.
Yeah. It's really, as you say, there's kind of the connections of sort of family names, but also there are certain characters who have features which are connected. So there's the boy who has owl-like eyes keeps appearing, so that there's this idea that these characters are very directly connected with each other, and this sort of story of human connection, I suppose, moves from one period to the next. Is that, again, one of those threads that you added in later to connect these distinct novellas, or had you always thought that that human connection would be at the heart of it?
Yeah, human connection is probably what each of the stories is about. Really, each section focuses on pretty much on two people and their interactions. In the case of the opening book, it's the young girl who's a member of the travelling Cuthbert community, and it's her relationship, not just with the idea of Cuthbert, but with this young lad who's kind of tagged along, who is called Owl Eyes. And they reappear throughout time. I think I'm interested in the fact that family names can endure throughout the centuries. England is rich with kind of local detail, and history is very well recorded here, and you can find family names that go back centuries. And I found out actually when I was writing The Gallows Pole, my novel, where I live in Yorkshire, there's so many people around today who are direct descendants of people who I was writing about several hundred years ago. So even though it's the 21st century and we move about and travel a lot more, actually a lot of people are still rooted in the, often could be living a mile or two away from where their great, 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 however many times grandparents were living. And I kind of wanted to convey that in Cuddy as well, even though Durham's an interesting city because it's several cities really, but it's on the one hand, it's increasingly dominated by the university, which causes a few problems in terms of local people can't afford housing now, and most of the buildings that are going up are sort of investment money from the university. So that's the downside. On the upside, it gives a kind of a northeast ex-industrial sort of heartland a much more international flavour in terms of the foreign students living in the city. So there's that side, and then there's the kind of deep historic side, and then there's the side of the element of people whose families have been there for centuries. And while I was writing the book, actually, I did one of those DNA ancestry tests. You know, you can
pay
80 quid and you send off a swab and find out your genetic geographical roots. So I did that, and I was really disappointed actually, because it came back and said that I was 89% northeast Durham and North Yorkshire, and 11% a mixture of Scottish, Irish, and Norwegian. So I'm about as northeast, about as northern as you could get, and I was really hoping for something exotic and interesting. And I just thought, and I live in West Yorkshire, so like I haven't even strayed too far from my genetic roots, which makes me feel a little bit local and a little bit League of Gentlemen, I guess, you know. but at the same time, you know, we are what we are, and that's what I am. And also part of that 89% was Essex as well, which was a little kind of, I don't know, I don't want to disparage Essex, but the one part of me that's not from the northeast of England is from Essex.
It was Essex. not exotic in the way that you were hoping, but perhaps exotic in some way.
Maybe, I don't know, a bit of Brazilian, a bit of African, a bit of far. I would take anything, you know, but no, yeah. But it's pretty much County Durham.
Well, I think there's a certain pride to be found in such, you know, steadfast roots in where you're writing about. Obviously, one of the things you're able to do with a novel that does span that period of time is to presumably have some real fun as a writer with the different styles of writing. So that opening section feels very much like an epic poem. We have those historical sources. You even write a sort of little mini play in the middle. So the section with Professor Fawcett Black, which reminded me very much of the beginning of Dracula in a way, because there was this idea of somebody going somewhere where thinks that he knows everything and his whole world is sort of turned upside down. I found that very enjoyable. And then, of course, the very modern sections. Is there some fun for you as a writer to be able to flex those sort of stylistic muscles?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, I really enjoy it. It's important to me to enjoy writing because I find it quite sort of, it's not an occupation, it takes over my entire life, as a lot of creative pursuits do. It's not a 9-to-5, it's all day, every day sometimes. And if that's going to be the case, then I've got to make sure I enjoy it and feel free in terms of what I do. But I'm also quite lucky because I've had many years of my book's been rejected. 10 years of no publisher really touching me, apart from small independent publishers, which gave me this sort of idea that I would just write exactly what I wanted to write at any given point. Because I thought, if no one's going to publish this in a kind of major way, I'll make sure I write books I want to write.
Hmm.
And as it happens, things have kind of picked up, and won some awards and signed to Bloomsbury. But I've kind of retained that stubborn, steadfast sort of creative freedom, because I think I could have written sequels to other books, or the Offing, my novel The Offing, has done pretty well in the UK, but in Europe it's done much better. And like in Germany, it's been in the top 20 for 3 years and sold several hundred thousand copies, because it's quite an accessible, bucolic, sort of sunny book. And I think other writers would have gone, okay, now I know how to do this, and I know what people want, and I know what sells. But instead of doing that, I've written something that's very challenging, and the early feedback suggests that people either really like it or really think it's a load of pretentious, challenging nonsense, which I'm fine with. And in fact, I've written another book that's probably going to come out in the next year or two, which is barely a novel. And it's set in Berlin in the early 70s. And it's kind of a lot of broken text, and it features photographs. So I think, to answer your question, yeah, I mean, Cuddy features poetry and diary. The section you mentioned, which you compared to Dracula, was definitely influenced by Gothic and horror and ghost stories, M.R. James, Henry James, Sheridan Le Fanu, things like that. And then, yeah, the final book is contemporary fiction. I think I wanted to try these different forms, but was too sort of afraid or unqualified to commit to each one for a full-length book. And there is a play in the middle. It's a one-scene play that bridges a gap between several centuries. And I'm not a playwright, and I don't consider myself a poet, but I've applied some of those techniques and forms to... I mean, it's a novel to me. I see it as a novel that just kind of questions what a novel is, and questions the truthfulness of historical accounts. Because as you say, history is to be questioned, because it's often written down by the victors, or it's written down decades later. And I think I've learned a lot about history, particularly British history, through fiction. You know, I think, Hilary Mantel's books about Cromwell, or Pat Barker's books about the First World War, have taught me more, because they humanize the situations of the characters in a way that makes it, I nearly said the dreaded word relatable then, but you know, you can relate, I think the best work about war is when you see it from the perspective, say the First World War, of a young soldier in the trenches covered in mud and crying for his mother. That teaches me more than reading the sort of long, weighty accounts of battles and dates and strategies. So I use these different literary forms to kind of get across that, these different voices. And
I suppose one of the interesting things about putting yourself, as you say, into the position of these people is that you mentioned earlier that you're not a religious person, but obviously at the center of this novel is a sainted figure, and you know, the reason why this incredible cathedral was built. How did you find writing about faith as somebody who doesn't have that, I suppose, that kind of thing in their life?
With trepidation, I think. It's strange, because when we say faith, we think of religion, we think of Christianity or Islam or whatever. But I think lots of us have faith in other things. And I think we're living in a post-religious world, in this country at least, where that faith is placed in other directions. For me, it's probably in nature and landscape and animals. And and in people, I guess, but that's a faith that's tested quite often. but yeah, I mean, I remember as a teenager actually sitting in Durham Marketplace. There's a monument called the Horse. It's a statue to commemorate some local dignitary. And some guy sat down and he was kind of like a young hippie guy with dreadlocks. And we were like teenage indie punk kids. And he sat down. He's like, "Hey, guys, can I talk to you about Jesus?" And I was like, "Yeah, okay." And I had this conversation with him, and he was out there preaching, basically, and he was trying to get young people signed up so that he could get God points. And we talked about faith, and I was like 16 or 17, and I said to him, "Well, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in your concept of God as you're explaining it to me." And he kind of had this glazed look in his eyes and this smile on his face, and he said, "Okay, yeah, that's cool, guys, but just to let you know, you will be going to hell." And I went, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you've just told me you don't believe in God, so you will be spending your afterlife in internal damnation and burning in pain for all of eternity," sort of thing, and then like high-fived me and then disappeared, sort of thing. And I just thought, whatever happens in life, I never want to be that judgmental prick. So if I'm going to be an atheist, and I'm not like a card-carrying atheist, I'm not in this sort of Richard Dawkins camp. I just wanted to accept what people believe and respect them for those beliefs. So if people have different religious faiths, then that's great for them. I'd rather it wasn't enforced upon me, and I'd rather judgment wasn't placed upon me. So I decided to write about faith in as open and sort of natural a way as possible. And I've got a background in journalism, so there's maybe a journalistic aspect. I'm writing about people who believe certain things at certain times. There were monks and priests and prostitutes and zero-hours contract worker and Christians, and they all have different beliefs, and I'm just presenting them to the reader. I have had a friend or two, a friend read the book, and he's a writer, but also son of a preacher and had a Christian upbringing. He said something very nice, which was that I haven't fallen foul of the sort of modern tendency to be judgmental about faith, or to be a little bit snide or a little condescending, because no one really knows anything. And just because I don't happen to believe in that idea of a bearded God in the sky, it doesn't mean anything that I believe is any more righteous than anyone else, really. I mean, I believe in science and I believe in facts and truth, but, you know, we're in an age where even the idea of truth is pliable and under discussion. So it's a novel about faith, but it's not about a particular faith. It's just about the things that people believe in to get them through the empty, torturous abyss of life.
Wow, that's a pitch that's just selling itself there, Ben.
I should point out it's Monday morning and I've not been up very long, so, you know, I'll be serious later.
St. Cuthbert, or Cuddy, was, of course, a man who wanted to really just be left alone so that he could dedicate his life to prayer and thought about God. So I wonder, to finish off, how you think he might feel about being the central character of a novel and celebrated in such a way. Do you think he'd hate it, or do you think he'd be quietly pleased?
I think he would take it in his stride, really. I mean, actually, it was only since the book is finished and I've had finished copies in my hand that I've realised that probably the reason I wrote it is, when I was younger and would go to Durham Cathedral, I had this notion that, I don't particularly believe in the concept of previous lives, you know, because I'm not sure how it would work on a practical level. But if human beings are made of physical matter and energy, then maybe that energy can be transferred throughout time. So which is my sort of roundabout way of saying I always thought in a past life I might have been a monk who was living adjacent to Durham Cathedral, because at a really young age I saw these monks' cells that they lived in, and I was told, you know, men lived in these little rooms and they spent their days either gardening or writing. They were the scribes of their time. They were the literate people. Mm. So they were basically writing down stories. And I thought, oh, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to just sit at home and write. And the life I lead is quite monk-like in terms of sitting in a room and writing, albeit a monk with Wi-Fi and a wife as well. So, but the appeal of Cuddy was that he, when I was doing the research, I read that he lived on Lindisfarne, and it's a little island. I think it's about 120 people live there full time. And it's in the sea, but connected by a causeway, so you can leave every day by car. But Lindisfarne was too hectic and it was like a metropolis to him. So later in life, when he was the bishop of the monastery there, he went to live on a rock. You know, it's an extreme move. He went to live on a rock in the sea off Lindisfarne. And while I don't think I could live with such hardship, I totally understood where he was coming from, because the older I get, the more I just find the world intense and noisy and kind of vulgar and banal. And it's exciting and there's lots going on, but I just sort of, I need a lot of space and peace, and I get overstimulated, I think, sometimes when I'm surrounded by a lot going on. And to write, I need that space. So I think the whole point of the book is that I was kind of trying to imagine what it must have been like for this guy who found a tiny village, well, a tiny monastery on a tiny island, too much to cope with. So they had to go and live in this brick building, a little stone building, pretty much where he, in his dying days, where he lived off raw onions and water, which I couldn't do either because I've got quite a delicate stomach and I don't think the onions would go well. But yeah, I think I'd like to think he would just take it in his stride, because even in life as a hermit, he was famous. And he was surrounded by lots of monks who were idolizing him and fussing around him. And then as soon as he died, he was sort of beatified and raised to the status of a saint. I think he would probably just accept it, groan, roll his eyes and eat another raw onion.
You say that the raw onion diet is not to your taste, but it seems that we might be all be heading there with the current food shortages and all the rest of it. It's turnips last week. Maybe it'll be raw onions next week.
Well, I was just going to say the turnip stories in the news last week seemed like all throughout writing Cuddy, I was kind of joking to myself about, should I have like a character in the Middle Ages who eats turnips? And I just thought, no, it's too blackadder to do that. The idea that there's just these peasants in sackcloths eating turnips, and then sure enough 2023 we're told, you know, you can always live off turnips. God, what's going on?
Yeah, who knows, the Cuddy turnip cookbook is only a publisher's thought away. Ben, thank you so much for chatting to me. I love the idea of you feeling connected to a monk in his cell. And with your ancestry DNA test recently, there's every chance that it could be true, that you are related to one of those very men.
Well, I could be, but would they have procreated and bred? This is a loophole that I noticed.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah.
I've got a character called Michael Cuthbert who's set in today, and a suggestion that he could be a descendant of Cuthbert. There's also that, how does that work when you're a celibate monk? So the book is already a failure 2 weeks before it's out.
I would say that has simply raised a gap into which you could write again. So a triumph for any writer to leave those mistakes. Ben, thank you so much. It's been really great to speak to you, and I so enjoyed the sort of, you know, the variety of this novel and the challenge that you took on. So thank you on behalf of readers, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me, and I'd just like to say thanks to Waterstones, who've been massively supportive to me in over many years in a kind of roller coaster career of, you know, struggle and success. And when my last book came out last year, I would make a point of going into wherever there's a Waterstones, I'd go in and try and say hello to whoever's working there and to thank them, because the great unspoken thing in the book business is, you know, there's this perception that you should do literary festivals and you should get yourself in the broadsheets and on the radio or whatever. Mm. But the real secret is booksellers, and they're not given enough credit, because if a bookseller in a certain store, whether it's Durham or Harrogate or Tottenham Court Road or these different ones I go in, if you get a bookseller who likes and supports your work, it is life-changing in a way. And Waterstones have just been a huge part of that. And I've never really had a chance to proper publicly thank the chain of stores. So thank you, Waterstones. And thank you, Will, for having me.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. I can take no credit for the brilliant booksellers, but hopefully some of them will hear that. Because as you say, an enthusiastic bookseller has the power to hand sell copy after copy after copy of books that they love. And so they do an amazing, amazing job. So yes, here's to the booksellers.
Yes. Chin chin, down the hatch.
Cuddy by Benjamin Myers is out now. And for a limited time, you can find signed copies on waterstones.com.